chair coming to show you. You're gonna
see,
love it.
See, okay, okay. See.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so get in your high chair.
Okay.
Okay, okay. Now I'm gonna buckle you in.
Wait, there's no saw in this one, is there?
No, there's no saw this time. That was last time you were too smart. But I'm going to tape your hands down. I hope that's okay.
No.
Yeah, no, it's fine. You'll see. Now, here's what happens.
Okay.
I'm going to put a towel over your head.
All right.
And then I'm going to punch you once in each eye.
Ow!
One.
Ow!
Two.
Ow! Ow!
And you can't do nothing. And that is magic. Ta-da!
What a horrible trick.
I liked it.
Hey, this is Almost Live with Paul and Misty, and at least this time I don't have to sew anybody.
No. Unlike last time when Rashi got a hold of your blade saw and cut Super Eka in two. It's a good thing they're sock monkeys and are pretty resilient.
I just don't understand why Super Eka keeps falling for it.
I don't know. I'm just glad that whatever magic holds them together allows them to kind of heal up or something. I think
mend.
It's cartoon character mend logic.
Yeah. However, I'm really glad that they did that as a cold opening, if you will, because of who we have with us today.
Yes.
At long last.
The magic theme, we have...
Wes. Are we calling you Wes McDonough?
That's what I go by now.
Okay. So we have Wes McDonough and Jonathan Pendragon with us today.
Yeah.
Yay! And Emily Almerna is
real
quick.
Yay!
Yay! Yeah, but unfortunately,
Super Econ Hobart.
Fortunately, I suffer from automatonophobia, which is fear of dummies, ventriloquist dummies, marionettes,
and sock monkeys.
And sock monkeys.
Excellent.
Do you really?
No. Yes, that's automatonophobia. That's what
really?
It's called.
Do you really genuinely suffer from it? Or
no, I'm just making that part.
Oh, okay.
But the word is accurate. That's what it's actually called.
Oh.
And you know, David Copperfield was a ventriloquist before he was a magician, which kind of explains a lot.
Oh wow! I did not know that.
Yeah, he actually
was he good?
I have no idea. I don't have any footage of. I've never seen him perform, but he has a huge collection of ventriloquist dummies at his complex in Las Vegas, from some of the most famous ventriloquists who ever lived.
Wow.
I still maintain that fear of ventriloquist dummies is not a phobia, it's rational thought.
You know what? I agree with you. If you walk through that hallway downstairs at the Magic Castle, remember where they used to have all those? And even now, the ones they have down there, they all watch you as you walk
through. I don't know who it was, but we took a guest to the castle, and it was either like someone's girlfriend or somebody we knew couldn't go through that passageway because they were so afraid of the puppets.
I think you're making that up because I don't remember that happening.
No, there was somebody who was really creeped out by it.
It is a genuine phobia.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I did an illusion called Alice for a long time. And the beginning of the illusionist was basically pitting my memory against the audience on Twilight Zone episodes. And you would be surprised how many people would bring up the episode with Tally Savalas and the doll.
Is that Talking Tina?
Yeah, Talking Tina.
That is
right.
That's the one that freaks me out. And then, to the point where they sell little toys.
The Talking Tina.
Oh, no. They sell the big one.
No.
They sell the big one and the repro bot. Last time I was at Bad Robot.
You stop talking now.
Guess who was sitting next to me in the waiting room?
She was not there.
Talking Tina was sitting right there.
God.
I was sitting there. And Talking Tina was standing right next
to
me.
Do you pull the cord and she goes, and I like you.
I don't want you to start screaming during this podcast, so I'm not going to say anything more than Talking Tina was there. And if we ever have a meeting at Bad Robot, we'll have to wait outside because she's right there in the lobby.
I love that he's like, I don't want you to end up screaming, but I'm just putting it out there that this exists. And it's really creepy and it's going to scare the snot out of you. Yeah.
What do you think would be the number one, just quick trivia question, and I did this trick for about 5 years.
Yeah.
What do you think is... the number one favorite episode, the episode everyone brought up,
Night of the Meek with Santa Claus.
Well, that's one of my favorites. John with
Art Carney.
Art Carney.
Yeah,
that's one of Paul's favorites
too.
Oh, and John Fiedler.
And that was one of the first ones they were doing on video. They weren't actually doing that one on film by that time.
That was a video. Yeah. It looks really cheap. You
it
know?
Does at that time, but still, it's a wonderful. No, it's not.
I would guess personally the one where the guy breaks his glasses from reading.
That's Burgess Meredith, Time Enough at Last. That was actually episode number one. That was the first one that was ever aired. People do mention that one, but there's one they mentioned. They also mentioned.
What about the one where the guy was in the zoo?
You mean the zoo on Mars?
Where he was the creature
in
the glass.
Yeah, that he's on Mars. Yeah. And that was Roddy McDowall. And people are like, All Over. I can't remember the name. I think it's People Are Like All Over. That was the point.
That's not
of it.
The one either.
No, Nightmare at 30,000 Feet.
Terror 20,000 Feet. And that was William Shatner. Terror 20,000 Feet. William Shatner. Yeah. That's Ties. The other one, I'll give you a quick hint. It was written by Richard Matheson.
Oh, Strangers on... No, that's not Richard Matheson.
Richard Matheson wrote a number of good ones.
So. To Serve Man.
To Serve Man.
Based on the Damon Knight story.
The one where they find the cookbook for mankind from the space aliens.
To Serve Man. Wasn't that written by Richard Matheson?
No, the original story was written by Damon Knight.
By Damon Knight.
You asked.
Did Matheson write the...
Jerks!
Because that's one of the ones that... Or is it Little Girl...
might have written the episode, but Damon Knight wrote the story originally.
Okay, I might be wrong about
that. It's actually called To Serve Man.
To Serve Man. So it is Damon Knight. Okay, I stand corrected.
It was either Matheson or Beaumont. I don't think it was Serve
Man. We discussed this once before, and we went looked it up, and I was proved myself right. Mm-hmm. Yet you have not corrected
it. We're looking it up right now.
Okay. Yes, we're looking it up.
Solving the fight.
To Serve Man.
Yeah.
But he did, Richard Matheson did write my favorite, which was Little Girl Lost. About the little, this is hysterical, little girl.
Oh,
in
yeah.
Bedroom and falls through a wall behind her bed. And then they take the bed away, and a physicist just happens to live next door.
Of course.
And he comes over in his bathrobe and happens to have a piece of chalk in his bathrobe. He starts marking the wall, showing where, you know, mm-hmm. where this hole into another dimension is. And it starts to heal up as they're trying to rescue the little girl.
Written by Rod Serling, based on a story by To Serve Man by Damon Knight.
Oh.
November 1950 issue of Galaxy.
Okay, 2 points for West. Uh-huh. I love her, but she's irritating.
I love Twilight Zone because when I was a kid...
she's smart and right. I think it's a good challenge for you.
Go ahead, Paul.
I love Twilight Zone because when I was a kid, I missed the first run, but I would watch the reruns, you know, because they would put them on late at night to scare dumb kids like me. And it would be like... And we didn't have TV Guide or anything. And there were only like six channels on our TV. So I'd be like, what's on tonight? And it would always be... I was always discovering it for the first time. And it would be like, things are starting off normal. And at the end, something horrible is going to happen. I don't know what it is, but everybody's going to have ugly faces or the devil's going to get out of the prison cell. And
ooh, the Howling Man.
Howling Man gave me the willies. And even though you see him transform into what's got to be the hokiest side of the hokiest devil this side of John Lovitz on Saturday Night Live, he's still scared the shit out of me because it's like the devil howling in a prison and the monks can't keep him in and now there's evil in the world. Oh my God, there he is. And he looked like the devil. And it was.
And so you became a writer.
Yeah.
No, John Carradine was... I thought I was kind of upset. I was terrified when the devil got out, but when he turns into basically something out of a Faust, a bad production of Faust with Mephistopheles.
Yeah.
It was like... But it was still really...
Yeah,
really scary.
Well, there seems to be a synthesis because you've got the magician and then you've got the storyteller. Where they meet is the shaman, and the shaman, you know, creates magic through stories.
To heal,
yes,
and to heal and to teach. Mm-hmm.
You have no idea how appropriate that statement was, considering who I was going to mention. But
oh, I know exactly who you're talking about now.
So does West.
Let me see.
But yes,
okay, thank you.
But the thing is that they start to believe their own publicity.
Yes.
And that becomes stagnation.
Especially when it's not their story that they're telling.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
The publicity becomes, is telling a story that's not theirs, and they buy into the lie.
They move backward and forward in time, if you haven't heard.
I haven't heard.
Yeah.
We'll have to tell you.
No, you don't.
Off camera.
But no, but there's
off camera.
Yeah, there's...
I'm not surprised, though.
You're not supposed... Yeah. But you're not... You know, if you look at yourself that way, then you'll stagnate. Because you'll feel, I can't be taught anything. I'm a great elder magician and then you die.
Well, that's when you get old, is when you decide that you're an elder instead of a neophyte who still has so much to learn. I've watched you and I have been so privileged to learn from you when I knew nothing and I was terrified to be next to you on stage. And then when we both kind of went off and had our own journey and I had so much learning to do about just standing on my own 2 feet. And you always had respect for me and saw potential, but I didn't. And it was very, you know, and it was an interesting time because I saw this tremendous teacher and I saw what a gift, you know, that I had been given by the universe. And I thought, what a tremendous opportunity to have worked with such greatness and to have learned so much. And then when West came and saw my seance audition, she said, you know, do you know this person? Do you know Jonathan? I said, yes, I do. And she said, I would like to reconnect you guys. It's been a long time since you've worked together, and I think it's time. I think that's the exact words that you used was, I think it's time.
And I want to break in here just long enough to say, watching you during this time period from when we first, because when I first proposed to you that mm-hmm. you work with him in the Peller show.
Mm-hmm. Oh my God. And what a, oh my gosh. I was so
cagey. You were being so.
I was so scared.
Deferential. And you were like, well, you know, I can just do, you know, a few minutes and he can do the rest of it. And, you know,
yeah.
And I'm like, no. We, you know, he like. I knew he would want to do something where it was very entwined and very cooperative.
Well, you're the one that put this whole thing together. The
but
show.
That first yep. show, you were so hesitant about putting your opinions in there and making what you wanted to do known and doing it. And then watching you over time and, you know, this last time you were there and you were as much in there. Well, coming up with ideas and
what
giving
was the word
opinions.
I used?
And...
Masturbatory?
Yeah, that's...
I have to tell you, I made Max laugh because I told him what we were working on.
Oh, that word's very appropriate because it happens all the time.
Well,
Oh, yeah.
You know, I actually talked about a card guy once and who I'll tell you about off camera. And I said,
but
you know,
I love
this
how
guy...
much your sense of self and confidence yeah. has grown over this time. And now you're rehearsing for your show at the Palace. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're putting that together finally. Mm-hmm. And I'm so glad you're finally
Well, and it's
that.
You. Oh, so much
it
of this
is past
you.
Time, girl. No. I knew when I first saw you do that seance, you know, tryout thing.
Yeah. I mean,
you had what it took.
But I thank you so much. Yeah. But the thing that I was going to say also, I mean, about both of you, first of all, thank you. My God. You know, like you were just like, I see something there. No, we need to do something with this because it's really going to work. And how right you were. This, you know, like this, you know, braiding was, you know, a lot by design. Go ahead.
I apologize, but and first of all, I tend to say mental masturbation because it's one of the things I hate with magicians.
Yeah.
Who are, you know, it's but the same thing is it's.
Well,
it's,
I always say they spent 15 years in their parents' basement with their deck in one hand and their dick in the other.
Yeah,
that's right. Awful.
Yes.
But,
you
no,
know,
but it's
well, that's the thing that keeps writers, you know, stuck in one place is mental masturbation.
Yeah.
But
and because they're terrified to go to that dark place that you guys have been to and you know so well. And you're like, no, it's not as dark as it seems because when I came out of this, I found this lantern.
Yeah.
Let me show you what it really
but
is. You
remember
know?
Night of the Raven?
Mm-hmm. Which is an Edgar Allan Poe themed thing that happens at the Magic Castle every November.
I had nothing to do with what you did there.
Right.
And so I was able to watch it as a layman, as an audience member, mm-hmm. instead of someone who knew what was going to go happen. And I've worked with you for such a long time. And what really made me happy about that is I'm watching your illusion and I'm going, oh, great, she's good choice. Yeah, and she's understanding light and the narrative is cool and the way it's put together. I'm seeing all the tools now being applied and being applied beautifully. And I was
thanks.
Like so proud because it was on your own and yet, I mean, again, it's like patting myself in the back. I'm not because it wasn't my performance. But the things that I hope to inspire in somebody, to have them understand that the magic is so much more than what people put into it. That there are all these elements that can make it, you know, so much better. And they were all there. And I was going, and it made me, instead of me feeling, you know, like so many magicians do, like, ooh, competition. Oh, Jesus, I hate her now. She's
not
competitive. Not me. It was like, yes, I was like the happiest guy in the room. I was going, oh, God, it's wonderful.
That's my baby.
But
yet still very much your own. And I have to say also working with him when we've had the opportunity to work with other people, you know, I've seen people who will try and work with people who are not going to make them look bad by comparison.
Yeah.
They'll always be the best one in the room. And Jonathan, every time it's come time to pick somebody to work with has always gone for who is the absolute best person he can think of who's going to challenge him every level, you know, step of the way, and who he's going to have to work hard not to be overshadowed by.
Mm-hmm.
So the fact that he likes to work with you is a big compliment.
I think he also likes that I give him shit because so many people are afraid of you. And
I like to give shit. It is. That's why I like.
But
I
am, you know, but we are very much like brother and sister now. You're like my really smart big brother, and I'm your pain in the ass little sister.
I am older than you, so I can say that.
Yeah,
okay.
Not that much, you know.
Oh,
but it's
come
but
on.
You know, but I mean, we really do work really together well because we are such good friends, and we have been through pieces of war. I have never been to the dark places, and I certainly wasn't there when you were going through that, because that was your journey to go on. Mm-hmm. However, we do have battle scars, co-battle scars from, you know, bad situations that we have braved through together, or something as simple as an embargo holding props back and having to make a list at 2 o'clock in the morning of, well, what do we have with us? And what can we buy at the CVS?
God, that's right.
Remember?
I
found that list about 3 months ago, and yeah. I still have it.
We had to invent an illusion from stuff we could buy.
And stuff you had
in
your
Barbados and in my carry-on. For the news.
And Jonathan watched this man invent out of necessity.
A motorcycle vanish.
Or production.
I can't remember.
It was a production.
It was a production of a motorcycle.
Because Brianna and I, all we had, and here's like, I mean, talk about necessity as a mother of invention. Mm-hmm. When you know a lot and you have life experience, I've watched him do two things. And I'll talk about the key if it's okay that I talk about this. Oh, sure, I don't know because I'll be exposing the method. But it's one of my favorite stories about you.
All right.
Three things actually. The first one.
No,
was,
two, sir.
What?
No, five. No.
Yeah, no. Seven.
Monty
six,
Python.
Five.
No, no, no.
Here
Monty
we go,
Python.
Off
you
the
know.
Bridge. So but I watched this guy. They said, okay, it's 12 o'clock today, and he was like, I have no illusion. And he said, nope. What do I have? I've got two black cloaks, a dragon cloth. Get me a motorcycle rider.
And a motorcycle.
Said, we have 3 hours. And he said, I have two cloaks and a silk. Get me a bike.
Motorcycle.
That's exactly what he said. And they said, okay. And he pulled Brianna, his niece, and I aside. And he said, all right, listen, this is what we're going to do. And this is what I need you to do. And he said, and this is how it's going to happen. And I looked at her and I said, he is a genius. And she said, he's my uncle. I said, yeah, he is. And I mean, it was really fascinating to watch that happen. And he said,
I have not heard that story.
And he lit it. Yeah. And he lit it. And he explained to the lighting guy why. And he lit it alone, because I don't think our lighting guy was there yet.
Nope.
The show lighting guy hadn't come yet. Mm-hmm. And so he lit it alone. He came out and he said, I need a wall of light here. This is exactly how I want it to look. And it was an enormous hit, so much so that because of the embargo, meaning they our illusions weren't there. Our show was on Saturday. It's Saturday morning. And
yes.
We got nothing. And we're on the news advertising, hey, there's a show tonight. That people loved what he did so much and this improvised illusion that they all said, we'll call in to work on Tuesday. And they rescheduled the show for 3 days later because what he did was so damn good.
Mm.
They all, what was it, 3,500 people?
A lot of people.
I mean, thousands of people did not return their tickets. They all came on a Tuesday to watch this guy work.
Wow.
Come on.
Yep.
It don't get no better than that.
Yep.
No
and
problem.
I have watched situations. I've also watched him take credit for serendipitous, amazing things that have happened to him on stage. This man's existence is blessed because he has a lot of work to do.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's wonderful the universe gives us jobs. But I watched you were doing a card stab, and there is a gimmick that makes the card stab work.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, there's a deliberate choice of what this card is. Well, the card went missing. And he threw the deck up in the air, and the woman who had selected the card said, I don't know how he did it, because her selected card landed in her lap.
No.
And he said, like that, and took his paws, and I said, you son of a bitch, you're a genius. And it was wonderful.
He hates that word.
Yes. Richardson, I think you're drunk. You think I'm drunk? Where do you see Lord Buckingham? You know that story? It's my favorite story. Theorist, real quick. Ralph Richardson and Gielgud are doing a play about Buckingham, and they have a Wednesday matinee, and they both get slammed drunk. But they remember they've got a show, so they get to the show 5 minutes before curtain, and Gielgud is playing Buckingham, so they throw him in the shower, throw coffee down his throat, and everything. But they send Richardson out on stage because he's got to do the opening monologue. Now in England, if you we say line. If you come go up on a line, they say prompt.
Oh, okay.
So he's on stage, and you know, and he's trying to go through his opening monologue, and he's doing it, and he goes up on a line, and he's got to call for a prompt. And the stage manager gives him the prompt, and he goes on far. This is an absolute true story. This is a famous story in England.
Mm-hmm.
And he keeps going, and he keeps going, and he's having the worst time in the world. He's stalling, whatever, until finally it's so bad that, and only this, you'd ever see this in British theater, you'd never see this in American theater, somebody in like the first row stands up and confronts Ralph Richardson. You know, this is like a god in British theater, and John Gielgud is the next actor, and they're both gods. It's Olivier Richardson and Gielgud are the god.
Oh my gosh.
You know? So they, So this man stands up in the front row and looks right at Richardson and points his finger and he goes, Richardson, I think you're drunk. And then Ralph Richardson comes up, breaks the fourth wall and goes, you think I'm drunk? Where do you see Lord Buckingham? And it really happened. I would give to have seen that.
Well, it's like the Tallulah Bankhead story. Do you know that one?
There was a lot of Tallulah Bankhead.
Oh,
one?
I know, but
at the party?
At the wedding?
No,
or she's
the wedding.
In the church?
No.
Oh, my God. I don't know. Who was it that was telling us this story? Was it Stan Freeberg?
I think so, yeah.
And I think I told it on the pod, but I'll tell you guys anyways. If I've told it, it's worth hearing again. She is sitting in church at 11 in the morning. I don't know if it was a funeral or a wedding.
I think it was a wedding or something.
I think it was a wedding, too. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And she was soused. I mean, just 3 sheets of the wind at 11 a.m. in church. And the priest comes by with the incense. He's walking up the aisle. And she's so inebriated, she leans over and goes, darling, I love your dress, but your purse is on fire.
That's great.
She was a good Alabama.
God, I love her.
There was a makeup guy. He was makeup, and he was very well endowed. And he would bring it out at any suggestion. He just
if
loved,
I were that well endowed, I'd bring it out.
No, he all the time, you know.
The
so he's at, he, so he so they're at a party, and he grabs grabs the hors d'oeuvre tray from one of the waiters, pulls it out, and lays it on the hors d'oeuvre tray, and goes up to the little bank and says, "Would you like a sausage?"
Uh-huh.
And there were like these little forks that you grab them with. She goes, "Oh, certainly." Grabs a fork and nails it.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I love her.
I love just. You know,
I haven't
just,
been invited
it's,
to this
it's
kind of
nail that larger than life, like in the moment, yeah. Like she's unmatched.
She's amazing. Mm.
So we're doing this show this weekend. Yeah, actually.
Metaphysics.
Yeah.
That's which is the title, I love the fact that this has evolved so well. And I really like where we're going on in this one. But
in which you play, because they haven't heard anything about this yet. So
I play a character that I've come up with. I came up with a long time ago, but I've developed it more and more and more.
And we'll get into why and how you developed it later, I'm sure.
It's inspiration. It's major inspiration are two people. One is Sherlock Holmes and the other is Hari Seldon.
Mm-hmm.
Hari Seldon is a psychohistorian who's in Isaac Asimov's Foundation stories.
Mm-hmm.
And although he only appears for a short time in the first one, but in the rest of the time he just appears in like a holographic state. He is a hyper-rational individual who can calculate the future, but only en masse. He can't calculate individuals. And I thought, wow, what an interesting idea. I don't like the way some mentalism is presented because there seems to be no mechanism. It's you know, they have this power, but they have a difficult time defining it themselves.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, which is why I wanted so much to perform with you because people are saying they think this is sexist, but this is not. You're a woman.
Mm-hmm.
And there is so much mythology about women's intuition and, you know, the oracle and Sybil and all of that, which doesn't exist in male mythology. You know, we don't, you know, all the male prophets.
The Sybil, not Sybil with
the MPD.
No.
And you're effing crazy.
Sybil from Greek.
Yeah,
That's I figured that, but thank you for clarifying for the listeners.
In case anybody was confused.
Right.
I mean, she said that was schizophrenic, but dang. No.
But, you know, you look at most of the male prophets and they're mad or they're crazy or,
mm-hmm.
you know, or nothing ever comes true. But females, there's this wonderful gravitas to all
there's
the
a
female.
To it,
yeah, to all the females. I go, wow, you know, that's really interesting because that is a perfect counterpoint to my thinking machine,
mm-hmm.
which is where the Sherlock Holmes comes into
mm-hmm.
it. And so that what an interesting. And of course, what's cool about this is that in a way this actually happened historically with Houdini, although Houdini was not a particularly intellectual person, but he was, at least about his craft, he was very, very studied. He worked very, very hard. And he would often, and one of his most interesting relationships was Marjorie, the Boston psychic.
Yeah,
who he knew was a fraud.
Mm-hmm.
And she would never quite admit it to him.
Yeah, actually, Jim Steinmeier wrote an entire play about those 10 minutes that they, a conversation they may have had.
Mm-hmm.
And it's fabulous. What did he call it?
Card trick, was it?
Card trick.
The card trick, yeah.
It's fascinating.
But it's So there's a lot of stuff that has peripherally actually existed before this, but it's never been brought into focus. And mm-hmm. so the chance of us, you know, bringing it into focus is like really so cool that I was really excited about doing it. Mm-hmm. And again, it's gotten great reactions, but I still think it's in a very early state, and it can progress.
It's still really fun.
Oh yeah, it is still
fun. And it changes. It's so, yeah.
But that's our character's evolving as well.
Hugely.
It's got to change. Mm. It's got to change.
Yeah.
You know, and I think this, for instance, the chaos trick that I actually came up with this trick for myself, and then I realized, you know, wait a second, this, you know, this would be great for Misty, you know, handing a newspaper to members of the audience and telling them to create absolute chaos, and out of this chaos comes a small piece of paper, and they're to choose a word, and mm-hmm. you define it. But it's just, it's that doesn't make sense for my character. It makes perfect sense for your character.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. And also use the different objects that we manipulate and use throughout the show. You know, like I'll pull out psychic silver, where you'll hand out calculators to the audience. You know, mm-hmm. and it's really fascinating. The levels of divination, where you arrive at yours through deductive reasoning, I arrive at mine through mystical means. And what we have really worked really hard on establishing is that in the middle of these two extremes is a very magical place.
Yeah, I really like the alchemy of some of the pieces that you've developed over time, where you take pieces that one or the other of you have done individually in the past and make them into, split it into a two-person thing where you each contribute your strengths to it, and it makes them into a completely different effect, and mm-hmm. it's a beautiful thing to watch, and but, just really works.
Yeah, but that's the denouement, is that we can't exist as individuals. We function best when we need each other, mm-hmm. when there's, I can't go to this place, but you can. So to get, it's like the definition of synergy, that, you know, the whole is greater than the parts, mm-hmm. and that's what we do when we work together. Then we're able to. I mean, I described it to somebody using John Nash's equilibrium, that we're both working towards our own gain to get the most we can. But when we work together, we can go even farther.
Yeah,
which is kind of what, you know, in a very simplistic way, is what he was talking about, mm-hmm. and that's really, and again, that is. You don't see that in magic. You don't see, mm-hmm. you know, meddlers especially. I just find that if you had to ask them about a backstory, you know, Uri Geller. Oh, I was given psychic powers by aliens. Oh, I believe that one. Mm-hmm. Or Dunninger. I was struck by lightning. And that's what they used to say. Mm-hmm. You know, and there's no backstory that's even remotely credible that the audience is, you know, where you can draw them into it.
Yeah, whereas in our case, yours legitimately comes from pain.
From
mental
illness,
that you've experienced.
Yeah.
And it's like, look, I learned these coping mechanisms. And these coping mechanisms kept me sane. These are the reasons that I'm not crazy, because I can't function mm-hmm. in normal society. And it gives a really credible, you know, like, look, this is just how my brain works. And I might as well entertain you with it, because this is my therapy, and thank you for coming on this journey with me. You know, I mean, it's not really your therapy. That's not what you do. But it's, you know, like, keeps me from being nuts.
But it kind of is my therapy.
Mm-hmm.
I had severe OCD, and I only got out of it by a fluke accident. But
and it's
I,
not even gone. It's just a
no,
lot more livable.
That's right.
Than...
The worst of it went away, but... The thinking patterns are still there.
Mm-hmm.
When I was 16 years old, but this is to show you how extreme this was and how my brain worked. And it's weird because my mother worked with mentally challenged children. And she said the thing that hurt her the most was when she realized that we think they don't know what they are. They know there's a problem. They're not oblivious to the fact that they're different.
Right.
And that's what, and my mom said, oh my God, you know, this is like the most difficult part about working with them is that everyone thinks, oh, they're just oblivious, they don't care. It's not true at all. And so when I had OCD, because of, at the time I had severe speech impediments, because of the unusual behavior, not letting people touch me, washing my hands 100 times a day, you name it, people thought I was either slow or odd or weird. And I knew I wasn't. Inside, I knew I was a bright kid. And And I knew people were treating me like I was dumb, and it really hurt. When I was 16 years old, there was a solar eclipse they talked about it in the news, and they were talking about, it had already been proven before with earlier solar eclipses, but there was an article about that my algebra teacher was telling the class about. They were going to, in Einstein's theory of relativity, he predicts that powerful gravitational fields, like a gravitational around a sun, will be able to bend light. And the way you could prove that, of course, is during a solar eclipse, because when the sun goes completely black, actually, it doesn't go back, you know, the moon comes, gets in its way, and we can see the stars. So if you map the stars at that point and then check them against a star map later on, you'll find there's a deviation. That deviation has occurred from the light traveling close to the sun and traveling through its gravitational field, bending it. Mm-hmm. So my teacher is telling this to the entire class, and I'm sitting there, and I had already ground my first mirror for a telescope. And I'm like, the light bends. It's interesting. Well, in deep space, if you had the right arrangement of supermassive bodies, wouldn't that create like what would you call it? A gravitational lens? So I raised my hand. I said, and I asked that question. And the teacher looks at me like, oh, God, the strange kid again, boom, boom, boom. And I was really upset. But, you know, everyone looked at me like, oh, there he is off again. And I went home and I researched it. And I wrote a letter to Sky and Telescope. And they, you know, I got an answer back saying, well, yeah, some people have actually theorized this, but it's not considered likely. It's kind of looked down upon by physicists. And I'm going, I don't get that. It makes perfect sense to me. Mm-hmm. And I started to follow the argument. You know, again, I came up with the idea completely on my own, but I started to follow the argument, you know. And again, it was kind of looked down upon. Then it gets a little bit more and more credibility. And they launch Hubble. And of course, originally it wasn't working that well. They fix it, so it does. They start taking pictures. And in the first year, they find 25 gravitational lenses. Not only did it exist, there are a lot of them. You know, and they show, it's like a ring. Mm-hmm. And they show the object, which is normally a supermassive galaxy. And around the supermassive galaxy is this ring, which is showing galaxies that are behind it. Yeah. And now that is acting like a lens. And now we can see in this ring parts of these galaxies that, you know, are basically, it's like a giant space telescope. And, you know, and I was going like, yes, I'm a 16-year-old kid, but I knew it. But I still also remember the embarrassment of kids, you know, treating me like I was some strange little kid, and always, oh, he's stupid. He doesn't know what he's talking about.
Someone gave me a deck of Osho Zen tarot cards, and that makes me think of a painting that I use as inspiration quite frequently when I feel that way. But in this Osho Zen tarot deck, there is a painting of a lion. And he's surrounded by sheep, and he's miserable, and he's got sheepskin on, and he's trying so hard to fit in. And you know that lion's story, and you know that eventually he's going to stretch and swat and go, oh, and remove the mask and be who he is, and you are literally a Leo. Like, that's your astrological sign.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I think that it's really resonant of your life story, because you have stood up and said, wait a minute, I am different, and I'm okay with that. And you stand in strength in a very solid way. And I think that's really neat. And I think it's really special that you're using it, you know?
And the nice part working with him is that he very much remembers that, because we started working together, and of course he is miles and miles and miles and miles ahead of me in magic.
But you have a lot of...
We were working specifically on trying to change the presentation of his sawing, so that it could be done without any extra assistance, just the magician and the person who is being sawed.
And the saw-e.
Yes. So we were just looking for a way, and I made some little suggestion, and the first response was, well, no, that can't be done. And I was immediately backing, okay. Except for he stopped, and he's like, no, wait a minute, let's play with this a little bit. And he tried it out, and it ended up, it was something that
theoretically should have been impossible based on the current state of things in magic. But it actually ended up being the breakthrough we needed to make it work.
Mm-hmm.
So he is very open to that sort of, and it's happened since then. The time machine thing that he was showing you.
Oh, that's so cool.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. And now I'm much more confident about putting that sort of thing forward. But mm-hmm. it's because, yeah, he's and probably as a result of things like that, he's always open to considering things that supposedly shouldn't be able to be possible.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Well, and it's a testament as to being a lifelong student and how great that can, how much knowledge you can amass when you are that dedicated to the process.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and also treating other people with respect. I love to work with him because I learn something every time. I have not had a single conversation with him. I mean, we have been sitting in the library at the Magic Castle, and you got on the floor and showed me the best position, the most deceptive position for an assistant in an illusion. And you just, I mean, just laid on the floor and showed me. Mm-hmm. Because it was apropos, and I wasn't asking for a magic lesson, but every day it is, mm-hmm. because I'm listening and learning and watching, and it's awesome. You know, I mean, it's just, it's been so, I'm so grateful and amazed, and amazed that I'm able to be on this process.
You know, yeah. As a kid, I remember the scariest moment of my life as a child, and people would find this strange. It was in Sunday school.
Oh. Really?
Yeah. And I was told about heaven. And as you would be taught in a Sunday school.
Sure.
And I was going, so I die and then I go to this place and I have eternal bliss for eternity. And the teacher goes, yeah. So I can just lay back and do nothing for eternity. And they go, yeah. And mm-hmm. I go, that's terrifying. Mm-hmm. I need a purpose. I can't. I mean, I went home and I was like shaking like a leaf going, my God, day after day with nothing to do, with no responsibility, with nothing to learn. It's like I don't want to go there. Not like I wanted to go to hell, but I just didn't want to go to some place where I...
And he truly goes nuts if he can't work.
Yeah.
That's his...
But I remembered yeah. that night of sitting there at home thinking about trying to perceive the endless.
Mm-hmm.
And this would be endless tedium and boredom. And to me, that was torture.
Mm.
It was the most, I mean, again, it was the most terrifying thing I'd ever heard of. This idea of that heaven is a place where you can just kick back and
do
nothing.
But one of the differences is that you absolutely love what you do. And there are so many people out there who are stuck doing something they really hate just because they have to pay the bills.
Mm-hmm.
No, I could never do that. It would go crazy.
You know, I had a very revealing conversation with my father at one point where I had been working in radio at the time, I think. And my family was also very conventional, and I was sort of a little bit the rebel as well. And certainly was considered to be the flake of the family. And there was one point where he was sitting down, he's like, just once, I want you to get a job and stick with that job for 6 months, just 6 months, get up, go to work every day. And I'm like, well, you know, Dad, I've worked at, you know, the name of the station for 11 months now. I've never missed an air shift. I've never been late, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And he looked at me and he said, the saddest thing I ever heard, he said, you enjoy that. That doesn't count.
Oh.
Whoa.
Oh, that is
sad. How remarkable.
What that said to me about... what that must say about his view of life and work and how he must feel about his job.
Uh-huh. That's very... And also that you earn money for being miserable.
Yeah.
He didn't want you to have a job. He wanted you to toil.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
A joyless toiling.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. How remarkable.
The other thing about heaven that's
scary... But there are a lot of people who are in that position and work uh-huh. is... And I've done that kind of job before, certainly along the way. You uh-huh. know, I've done the 3 minimum wage jobs at a time, and it grinds you down and it's miserable. Mm-hmm. And if you're in that sort of situation, then the idea of endless rest must sound blissful.
No, but...
But you have always pursued what was in your heart and what you cared about and what you loved.
Yeah, but the other thing about heaven that I find so terrifying is that I suffer from dialogophobia, which is fear of talking to God, because the conversation would be tedious. I mean, the best that God could do is feign surprise. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
That's pretty true.
I mean, but I mean, I make a joke about that. But it's, I mean, when you think about those concepts of being, I mean, I can't imagine being all knowing because there'd be nothing left to learn.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, there's no fun in that.
Yeah.
You know, what's the fun in that? It's not.
Yeah.
So
let's just very quickly and briefly before we get into this talk, I'm sure we're going to end up talking about Batman and a ton of other things. Let's just tell him just really quick, and we touched on it a little, that it's character work, but you guys have all seen the show.
Wait, we're having a circular conversation.
Oh, yeah, it's fantastic.
Yes, circular.
It's getting weird. Ooh. Go ahead.
Just what, you know, the people that are coming this weekend, kind of what we're working on. Without tipping too much.
We're working, you know? We're trying to develop our characters to the point where we really show the difference in our approach to life and to our magic,
mm-hmm.
and yet this need for each other, that, you know, the show that, I mean, again, it's the very essence of metaphysics. And in that regard, you would represent, you know, the ethereal, the, because, mm-hmm. you know, that's where it came from. I mean, Aristotle, they were cataloging Aristotle's works, and mm-hmm. Aristotle wrote on everything. So they, okay, and this is in the Great Library of Alexandria. So they go, okay, that goes in biology, thump. Oh, here's physics, thump. Here's mathematics, thump. You know, and they're literally cataloging it.
Sure.
And then they get to his work on the interpretation of dreams and the soul. And there's someone's going, well, where the hell do we put this? And they couldn't figure out where to put it. So someone said, well, put it between the physics. And of course, in Greek, between the physics, metaphysics.
Mm-hmm.
So because it fell between the cracks, because it was something that didn't belong in any, but it was something very important. This, you know, this is how this was born. So I am the physics. I am the biology and the mathematics and the chemistry. And you're the interpretation of dreams. You're the soul. And
the meta.
You're the meta.
Yeah.
That's right. And they can't exist apart.
Right.
And so if we can show this to the audience without beating them over the head with it, without becoming preachy, which is always boring.
So our show is the hyphen that connects the two words.
That's right.
Yeah.
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 And that we show each other's strengths and then the need. And the better we can tell that story, the, you know, the cooler it is.
And we've been having so much fun with it. I mean, we originally started this with the idea of sort of exploring a Holmes and Watson type relationship, because we do have that dynamic. You know, right. we squabble and we bicker like brother and sister. We literally smack each other sometimes when we're working together, not on stage, you know, mm-hmm. but I mean, we have a hell of a lot of fun together. And, oh, yeah. you know, and so there's a lot of play in there as well. And we, you know, explored that dynamic of, well, this is the way it is. Well, that doesn't have to be the way it is. What if we did it this way, you know? And so, and it has been morphing as we've come along. And I'm really proud of where it is. I'm really looking forward to it.
It was interesting because there was Helder and DeGaudio did apparently a really, really wonderful show.
Oh, interesting.
Of card magic that was really a show. But it was the two of them basically, it's kind of like card tricks in tandem. I never saw it, so I can't talk about it. But people really liked it a lot.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, again, that was like card magicians and that. Uh-huh. And I think, okay, these guys are young. They show real smarts. You got to take it farther. You know, this isn't synchronized swimming applied to card tricks. You know, this, you know, that's not enough.
Well, it's not who you are and it's not who I am. No. One of the reasons that we initially connected and started working together was we both approach magic with a theatricality philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like we come, it's character-driven magic, and we both answer the question. One of the things that we have both demanded, not only in our individual shows, but especially in metaphysics, is why? Why in the hell are we doing this? Why do they want to come on this journey? And we actually just modified an existing effect for this show. I don't know how into it you want to get, you know, because we're still working on it, you know, like as far as the 100-to-1 effect.
Oh, I,
you know,
that's,
we took
an existing
effect.
That was funny because I'd come up with this effect in the early 1980s.
And it's in your character notes
also. It's in my character notes, yeah.
Which is a, you could please tell them what it is.
And well, it may have existed before me. I never knew of it existing before me. But I worked with Harry Anderson on Russian Roulette. And Russian roulette has been presented as a magic trick, as a mental effect in forms.
Explain to them, please, what
Russian roulette is. What's like the game, except that
where you spin a bullet in a gun,
right.
And you spin
and
the
you
chamber,
spin the chamber and you pull the trigger. So the magician has to predict when the gun is going to fire.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Harry started working on a routine, and then he started to perform, and finally he used to stop doing. He goes, it doesn't work.
He was doing it with a gun?
Yeah, with a naval cult.
Okay.
And he said, it doesn't work. And I said, why? He said, because nobody's going to believe I'm going to put a gun to my head twice a night for $500 or whatever it is, you know, mm-hmm. whatever the show is giving, you know. He goes, they're just not going to buy it. Mm-hmm. They and there is danger. There was, his method wouldn't have killed him, but there was danger, you know. Mm-hmm. And he said, you know, the danger I'm going through, they don't even believe exists because they don't think I'm crazy enough to really do this.
Well, the game is rigged.
Yeah, the game's rigged. So they go, he's going, there's no way. And I said, well, then the trick would be to come up with a threat that wouldn't hurt, but wouldn't be fatal that they might get into. And I said, and so then I came up with this idea of taking like five, sometimes four styrofoam cups, and I put an office spindle under one.
Okay.
And I would have them mix them up, and then I would begin to crush.
Like a needle.
Yeah, an office spindle, a needle sticking straight up. Yeah, big
one. It would hurt.
I remember I used to impale the paper on it in an office. That's an office spindle. Mm-hmm. And so I would crush the styrofoam cups one at a time, you know, of course, trying to avoid the one with the spindle because then it would impale my hand. Mm-hmm. And I started doing that because the mechanism is so primitive, there's no way of cheating that. They knew it wasn't a rigged game, but it scared me because I could make a mistake and I would have put the spindle through my hand. So when I published it, in Genie magazine.
Mm-hmm. Which is a magic periodical that still exists.
Yes, where I had a little stand and a beautifully hand-painted egg. And the idea was to avoid destroying art, something of artistic nature.
Oh, how nice.
And then I thought of a comic version of putting a real egg underneath there. And the idea was to avoid making a mess. But that's the sensibility I didn't like. The egg thing was better. And I stopped doing it. Years passed, and all of a sudden, other people started doing it. Some of them came up on their own. I don't know the genesis of it, but mine is in print in 1986.
And when it came, when it resurged, it was a big spike.
Well,
like
people use spikes, right? They use swords, they use knives, mm-hmm. and they would shove somebody else's, an audience's member's hand down on it. And
oh my God.
There have been a lot of accidents.
Oh my God. I can't even imagine.
Some guy, go on YouTube, yeah. And it's horrifying of these guys making
these. I can't watch it. I can't watch it.
Yeah, it was particularly these tricks.
Oh, God.
And I was sick. Because
why would you do that?
No, I was sick. I said,
you're an idiot?
So I go, I'm going to come up with a foolproof method where you, even if you make a mistake, you can't get hurt.
Mm-hmm.
So I came up with a method of making the spindle that even if you came down on it, and this is exposing it in some way, but it's a safety.
Uh-huh.
It would collapse without harming you.
There's a safety, yeah.
So there's a safety involved. And then we were having this conversation. You turned to me and said, you know, Wes said, you know, I don't like spindle tricks. I don't like the idea of the impalement. And you were, you know, and you said, you know, well, what about making a bet?
Actually, at first I called it masturbatory.
Yes, you did.
And yes, I said, why in the hell would the audience want to go on this journey with you? Like, either you're a sick puppy.
That's right.
And you are, a masochistic individual that is forcing them to watch this because nobody watches that without cringing.
Yeah.
You know, or the game is rigged. And I said, so what other, you know, like, what risk would the audience actually be invested on? And you...
But you made the thing about the bet first. And
uh-huh.
Then,
I said, what about money?
Yeah, what about money? And I said, wait a second. You know, this is a true story, which is very famous in my family. And, you know, I knew it for years. Wes mm-hmm. actually found it as well, because it's a very famous story. That, again, my real last name is Yarbrough. And the Yarbroughs were famous for gambling. And there was a particular bet that...
There's actually a bridge hand.
Yeah, well, this is where it comes from. This is the story.
Oh, okay, I'll stop
talking, sorry. There's a bridge hand called a Yarbrough. Mm-hmm. And... But it wasn't
because
invented.
Because they were all gamblers.
It wasn't invented. What happened in bridge? It came from something, from a bet where, in any game where you would, like in hearts or whist, where you would deal out an entire
deck
to four people. So everyone gets 13 cards. One of my ancestors would bet that one of the hands would be what is called a no honor hand, which means nine or below.
Oh.
There'd be no 10, queen, jack, mm-hmm. king. I'm not sure if ace is involved. Maybe ace may have been one in this one.
Okay.
So it would not have any one of those 10, jack, any 10 count card would not be there.
Right.
So
he had a running side bet.
That was a running side bet. Now, the odds of dealing in a four hands, the odds of one of them being a Yarbrough is about 1,800 to 1.
Wow.
But he would give people 100-to-1 odds. So, you know, because he lost so often, people would bet enormous amounts of money. And he was playing with King Charles II. And Charles made an enormous bet, and he lost. One of the hands was a no honor hand. And so
we don't actually know that this was this. Oh, sorry.
But this is, well, we don't know. But this is the story.
Uh-huh.
I mean, this is, yeah. It may be apocryphal, it may not be, but this is a story that's told.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So he paid it off with land in the New World.
Oh, wow.
And the Yarbles came to America.
Oh, my God.
That's a true story.
Yeah.
As far as we know.
Yeah.
But it's a story which existed before me.
Yeah.
I heard the Yarbrough story growing up because my father was a bridge player and a fanatic gambler. So when you said, oh, money, I said, wait, I could tell this story and we could, you know, mm-hmm. And you said, and the bet would be that I put a shot glass down, I put a $100 bill in the shot glass, and then I cover it with a styrofoam cup and just say, mix them up. If I crush that glass, two things are going to happen. One, it's going to hurt like hell,
mm-hmm.
but it's only a shot glass. And two, I'm going to crush down on the money. If I do that, you win. You get to keep the money. But if I miss it three times, if it's going to be four cups, I win. Would you bet $1 versus my $100? And of course, somebody will do it. So they'll put the dollar bill down. And of course, three times I'll miss it, and the last one I'll get a.
Nice.
But.
And you got the tension because it's a bet, not a.
That's right, because mm-hmm. The bet,
yeah. Not potential
right. The
violence.
Bet for the player.
But yeah. And again, that came out of Misty and I sitting together with West and going over. Okay, I don't like it for this reason. I don't like it for this reason. Yeah, well, God, can we do anything about it?
Wait, and how do we make it more us? Yeah.
Yeah, how do we make it more us? Well, my last name and this bet, and you know, and I came up with the spin. I'm just going. God, this is so much better. So I just threw my spindles away. I said, I'm never going to do it that way again. It's stupid. I love the shot glass and the $100 bet and the fact I get to tell a true story. Well, mm-hmm. An apocryphal story maybe, but I didn't write it. It's a story that's famous in my family, and you can find it in books to talk about it.
Well, you can add this part out. What I was going to say is you've actually conflated two stories about Yarbroughs.
Okay.
There's no telling. There's the story, there's the bridge hand one, which is a known thing.
Right.
And then there's also the story that the reason the family came to America is because someone won a bet with Charles II.
It was a Yarbrough one.
He played
off
a bet with land.
Right.
But it's not necessarily the same one who did all the bets on the
hand. Yeah.
And it's not necessarily, that was not necessarily the bet they had with the king.
That's right, but it was still a Yarbrough betting it.
Yes.
They're both Yarbroughs. Yes. I'm thinking two famous Yarbroughs.
They're all gamblers in the family.
Because my dad, and which was funny because when I in close up, I do a trick with four silver dollars, which are Morgan silver dollars. And they were first minted in 1878. I've got one from 1878.
Mm-hmm.
And the story that I tell, and it's not true because I had to buy, but I used to, when I was a kid, I used to have them, and then I don't know what happened to them. But my father, I was probably in Vegas the first time I was 6 years old.
Uh-huh.
And my father would go gambling. And at that time, kids couldn't go anywhere near the casino. There was no place for us to go. So I sit in the hotel room. And he'd come back. And whether he won or lost, he'd always brought me a silver dollar.
Aww.
And I had like 40 of them at one time.
Wow.
So, and again, I lost it. But eventually I went out and I bought a bunch of Morgan, these old Morgans. They're all from the 1800s. And in the close-up room, I tell the story about, I'm from a family of gamblers. My father, and this is again a true story. My father would go to Vegas and he'd bring me back. I said, Morgan silver dollars. I use four of them. I do a trick. And the story is the truth, except that these aren't the silver dollars he actually gave me. I don't.
Mm-hmm.
So it's mostly true, but it's, you know. But that was.
But it goes back to, and, you know, and we'll talk about, like I said, we alluded to this earlier, and we'll talk about this much later, because I want to bring it up again, about how important storytelling is in your magic. And we have really taken, you know, the show that we're doing this weekend is a direct result of personal stories. Things that we really are inviting the audience, windows into our souls, really, essentially. You know, I mean, you know, to use that old thing about the eyes.
Yes.
But they're all very personal effects. We're not making this stuff up. This is who we are. Mm-hmm. And we've taken strong, sort of exaggerated versions of our real personalities and the way that we interact anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And the rubber band like, you know, dynamic that you and I have, you know, you're way on this end, I'm way on that end, but we do have the exact same philosophy, and that's where we meet in the middle.
And to the point that even new things that I'm working on, that I don't, you know, like the trick that Wes and I came up with, which we're going to call the Anubis Gate in honor of Tim Powers. I had a logic problem in it where I'm going, I don't know how I make this leap from this point to this point. And then I thought, wait a second, I can't make that leap, but Misty can. Mm-hmm. And it solved the problem within the narrative of the story. That when I realized, wait, no, I have that, because this person I perform with is completely within her skill set, as far as what the audience understands to be her skill set, not our craft, not our theater, but as far as what your inherent logic and what you tell the audience you can do, this makes perfect sense.
That character story,
but chaos, yeah, story, it doesn't. Actually. But it doesn't match my story. For me, this would be an illogical leap of faith. Mm-hmm. For you, it's completely within it. And I was going, well, that is so cool, you know.
Yeah, I'm just really excited about it.
So am I.
Yeah.
We do a hell of a... I've got a great new outfit that's like really drop dead.
It's pretty intense, I gotta say. Cool. I looked at what he's gonna wear and I was like, shit, I gotta step it up. That's not okay. Well, you guys did a good job with it, I'll tell you
what. Thank you.
Well, I'm really excited about it, and I hope that that you guys are excited about it at home too. Eventually, we'll probably put video up of it somewhere. But that's not going
to
be this weekend.
Oh, I need to make arrangements to get that taped.
Yeah. We'll take care of that. but anyway, I'm very, very excited, and we've got a lot of long, fun conversation coming up for you guys. So stay tuned for more West and Jonathan.
Knows this because she's psychic.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. I'm estimating there's approximately 220 minutes of dynamic conversation ranging in everything from, let's see, what will we touch upon?
James Bond, too.
Yes, James Bond and some personal interactions with celebrities.
Doctor Who.
Yes, Doctor. Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, he's just back from his...
The time machine, the TARDIS, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'd call you a genius, but I'm in the room.
Exactly. He's so modest. All the way down to, I don't know, maybe some Harley and Ivy funky action.
Anything Batman. Is possible.
Throw some Batman in there for sure.
Yeah. So we'll see you guys. It's going to be a hell of a couple of weeks. And so we're doing a show this weekend, so we're busy. But tune in next week for more.
This has been another episode of Radio Rashi. If you've enjoyed this episode, let everyone know by leaving a review in the iTunes Store. It's a great way to help others find us. You can also leave comments on RadioRashi.com, Facebook.com/RadioRashi, or follow us on Twitter at Radio Rashi or at Paul_Dini to leave us questions. Thanks for listening, and tell your friends.